Hello and welcome to the Green Room at Furnitubes. I'm your host, Catherine Barrett, and we're here every month with a new episode. Join us for industry musings, interviews and discussions exploring all things landscape architecture, street furniture and urban design. What happens when you remove cars from one of the busiest roads and intersections in London and prioritise people and plants? We have the new Strand Aldwych. The redesigned Strand is an award-winning scheme, and joining us today is the design lead of the Strand and director of landscape architecture practice LDA Design, Canon Ivers. We've got lots to talk about today. It's a wonderful scheme. I'm sure many of our listeners have been there to look at it. It's very talked about. Can you tell us a little bit of the history of the Strand before we go into the project itself?
I like to describe the Strand's history as a tale of two histories, one being really old and the other being quite new. So the Strand itself, we found maps from AD 190 showing as an old Roman road. So it has always been an east-west connector. So that's the old part. And then the relatively new is the Aldwych part, the upper part, the circular part of the D, which finished in 1905. So it's right. Relatively young in city-making terms. So you have these moments where you get the collision of those two histories, one ancient east-west about connecting key pieces of London, and then something that was new about picking up the trends at the time, which was big, wide, Parisian-style boulevards.
Yeah. And so then thinking of the other part of the history of the project, how did the original brief come about?
My understanding is the North Bank bid commissioned Publica to pull together a visioning feasibility study to test whether cars and buses could be removed from the Strand. Did it need to have buses coursing through it still? Right. So they went through a number of iterations about what could be achieved with Norman Rourke Prime as the traffic engineer to really to tease out what was potentially possible. And that then was pulled together as a vision statement, and Westminster got hold of it and said, well, let's try to make this a reality.
Wow. And so, you know, you guys came on board, I think, back in 2018, 2019, from memory.
January 2018. So there was an invitation by Westminster for anyone who was interested in the project to come and have a briefing. We went to that. We then pulled together our response and submitted, and then were appointed in January of 2018. Seems so close yet so far away.
Right? I know.
Coming up to the
five-year mark. Yeah. But actually, for what's been achieved, 5 years actually doesn't feel so long for that turnaround to have happened. Sometimes decades can pass.
That's right. I think for such a significant transformational scheme in a really dense part of the city with historically significant structures, incredible institutions, both educational and cultural, the fact that you're able to make such monumental changes as far as moving traffic around and changing the way in which the city operates.
Yeah,
5 years is very quick.
Yeah, it's pretty quick. So then talk us through your design process.
I think on this one, it was a slow entry from a conceptual design and creativity point of view. It was really trying to get under the historic skin of this part of London. How had it come together? Mm-hmm. Which were those pieces of the puzzle that slotted in to make it what it is? What's fascinating about it is every building there has its own rich, deep, sometimes troubled history. So it was a case of trying to understand how can we become part of that long arc of history in a way that it's going to respect those buildings, going to respect those narratives, respect the historic significance of the two churches, not to mention Somerset House and the other listed buildings.
Yep.
So we came at it from really trying to understand deep research into its history to try to put those pieces together.
Right.
And then to think, really, what are the parameters that we can't change? How does the sun move across the space, for instance? Where does it land? As a result of that, is that where people are going to want to sit? We've just gone through a hot spell, so now I'm thinking, where's the shade that people might want to sit? But really, it's the analysis of those things that we can't change to really understand how it works. Existing trees that have been there for 100 years, those are assets that really give the space an identity as well. So you need to work with those, make sure that they're kept as they are. And then understand who are the people that are operating there now and potentially in the future. It's an incredibly complex and rich and varied user group that courses through that, from workers, from students to visitors that are just coming to London to see Somerset House or to go to the Coulthard Gallery or go to the embassy. So you have all of these different strands of society that are were always overlapping there, but you could never see them.
Right.
Because it was such a hostile,
loud... Well, there was nowhere for them to go, to meet.
Exactly. And it was loud and it was hostile and it was polluted. So people would go and they would want to get into their relative institutions as quickly as they could because they could escape the traffic and they could escape that noise. So it meant that it was never really a part of the city that spoke to each other or had any kind of conversation or cross-pollination. So really it was a project of trying to unlock some of that and make it, you know, something that's distinctly different, hopefully, than to other parts of the capital.
100%. And so how did you then think about the space for people? And how did you see them using the space? And then how did that influence the design? Because obviously you started off with a space that wasn't used, and you have, as you say, all these amazing institutions with lots of people inside them. How could you sort of look to see how those spaces could be used?
Throughout the design process, it was really important that we could convey to people what something like this might feel like. Because it was a very hard project for people to visualize.
Yeah.
Because they had seen traffic for as long as it's been part of London, whether it was horse and carriage or buses and cars, it's always been about traffic. So I think the first thing was the assembling of the different stakeholders that Westminster and the North Bank BID did brilliantly. They brought together different groups. One was around operations. How does the space work? How's it going to be managed, maintained, looked after in the long term? Does it operate well as far as servicing? And then they had a separate one, sister group to that, was more around culture and activation.
Yep.
So with those two set up, we then started to have really just open-ended conversations and questions about what makes good public space. Should it, how inviting should it feel? How generous, how welcoming, how democratic should it feel? And that started to give some direction to the project, let's say. So we hadn't even really put pen to paper and started to think about what the space configuration might look like, the scale of it. Really starting to understand from that conversation of 70 plus stakeholders.
Wow.
There's a big collection of people that are...
Yeah.
So you might think it's really complex. How do you move a ship like that through? But I think everyone was so excited about the possibility of this change.
Invested in it working.
That everyone was really rowing in the same direction to make sure it became a reality.
That's awesome. And so can you describe some of the spaces for me? I know that there are, what's lovely about the Strand, they're these kind of rooms almost, or areas. Can you talk me through some of them, what you like about them, how you approach them, how they came into being?
First thing we really like to do is understand the scale of a space.
Yep.
And so this was a good example of trying to find something within the general context that people could go and visit and orient themselves. We found the Piazza at Covent Garden was a really useful scale comparison and a touchstone space for people to understand how big, potentially a large open space might feel like in that area.
Yeah.
And at the same, trying to think about how do you create something that is more intimate. So we were looking at the scale of the space, thinking about where people might sit in the direction of the sun. Those are some key driving principles. And then we set up three dialectics. One was, can we create a space that's both tranquil and energetic and have it functioning that way simultaneously? Could it be temporary and permanent? That sense that there's this open-ended, flexible nature where there's space is left for the unknown. And then you have the permanence, which is sitting in the garden and being quiet and being tranquil and being peaceful. And then the other was thinking about how do we make this long linear street more episodic, meaning it goes from a series of rooms or a series of moments or experiences, because it is a long linear stretch. It's always been a street. So how do you think about a linear street as a space? And that's where the idea of the rooms really started to come from, was that how do you create variety? How do you create choice when you're moving across a length of 350 meters? So we came up with three options that we presented to the stakeholders. And from that, there were bits and pieces from each that came together to form the hybrid and the chosen option. And that was about organizing a series of these distinct moments or these distinct rooms within an organizational structure, a change in paving, really, that says we have all these disparate pieces that have different experiences, different feels, but let's hold it together within the landscape in that way. So if you go from west to east, we start with the garden room, which is the first secure edge.
Yeah.
And that was about creating an inward-facing seat that looks into the space, protects you back from the traffic. We call that the garden room. Then we had the next room is the spectator edge, which is a bespoke edge that's being designed right now with Millimeter. And that was to look onto the open, flexible performance space. And then we had the moment we have what's called the social seat, which was designed as one continuous element, but because COVID came, we were able to think creatively, and that's now a collection of individual chairs.
Oh, that's the amazing, the rainbow bench,
it's called. So that will face on ultimately to the space that's used for performances and installations. Yep. And then you move on to a place where we thought we want to bring people together around food. That's the best time to have conversations,
yep.
whether it's students or visitors or whatever it may be. So we created the collective dining area. Then you go around the corner where St. Mary Lestrand, right in the middle of the space, and there's the workstation, so a place you could still be plugging away on your work or studying, yep. but be outside with Wi-Fi and being able to plug in. And then around the church was one of the big moments, was to say, how do we create that idea of the sanctuary in the yeah. city? So even when it was a four-lane traffic area, the church itself had this quiet front courtyard that felt like you were stepping into something different. It was cleaner, it was quieter, it was greener. And we thought, can we amplify that and expand the notion of the sanctuary? So the garden that wraps the church is called the sanctuary, another one of the rooms, as it were. And then finally, as you move further to east, you have the activity lawn and yeah. the garden walk.
Yeah.
So that collection, if you do move through, and it is, I think it's important you experience it
yes.
in that linear fashion and yeah. get a sense of that there are choices that people can make about how they want to sit in the space. And the idea was to create that variety.
And you really get that sense as you move through. So then how did you think about the planting, I guess, as a whole, but then also how did the planting add kind of like the depth and another dimension to each of those areas?
Yeah, so the project itself stretches from Waterloo Bridge, as I mentioned, all the way to St. Clement Danes, which is
yep.
the second grade one star listed church on the eastern edge of the space before it turns to Fleet Street. And we wanted that church to feel part of the larger project, which is obviously also making significant improvements to Aldwych that wraps around and changing on the junctions. But we really felt that that should be the gateway if you're coming from Fleet Street in the east.
Yep.
So we wanted, in a way, the materiality, both soft and hard, to start there, for that to be the signal that you've stepped into this as a new threshold, a new gateway. So the aim was to have planting that began at St. Clement Danes and wove its way all the way through to Waterloo Bridge,
mm-hmm.
both in understory herbaceous planting and grasses to the amelanchier trees that course through. Originally, we started with cherries, and then conversation said, let's find something that's got a bit more robustness and might
yep.
be more durable in an urban setting. And amelanchiers are amazing because you get incredible spring blossom.
Right.
You get berries that you should be able to eat in the next couple of months.
Yeah.
And then the fall color is extraordinary as well. So it is a hardworking, good urban tree. But the idea of the planting, so it goes back to my formative learning about plants, which is not that long ago. I was working with James Hitchmo from the University of Sheffield, who's
yes.
the mastermind of creating spaces from seed. And he used to always describe planted design as a good theater show or a good production, that you have a cast of characters that come and go.
Yep.
You have a star performer who quietly recedes into the shadows as the next star performer arrives. So the aim was to create this tapestry of plants that comes and goes throughout the year.
Yep.
So if you are someone who, say, works at King's or a student at King's or visits Somerset House frequently or go to the embassies or the Coulthard Gallery or the churches, that there's this idea and a sense, almost a palpable sense of the passing of time, that you can see the changes of the plants. And you can really see that if you arrive in the spring, you see the blossoms of the bulbs and all the way through to the alliums doing their thing. And then the summer color will take over. And then the grasses emerge and it becomes, you start to see the wind. So planting has this amazing ability of,
yeah.
of not just showing the passing of time, but creating different feels of the
yeah.
space. So that idea of the rooms is reinforced by the character of the planting as you move through. And it does feel that as you go from the west, slightly lower in the garden room, more open, so it doesn't have as much biomass as far as the amount of green. And as you move further and closer to church, it really
right.
becomes about being immersed in nature.
Nature.
Yeah, like you're enveloped by everything that's going on. And you feel a real sense of intimacy.
Yeah.
And see people finding their place and staying there and taking out their books. And that's, you know, that's the whole point.
And it really is that. I mean, every time I've been there, seeing people having different moments, whether it's taking this time to themselves or you've got a group of people somewhere else being more energetic. Yeah, it's incredible. Really cool.
That's right. And then you have, if you go all the way to the eastern end at St. Clement Danes, it's a broad open area because the way in which buildings were set back in 1905 when it was finished, you have these big, broad open areas of sun. So the sky is wide and sends light down there. And still, the planting there creates an atmosphere, but it's not as intimate as around
right.
the church. Yet, you know, you can still see the passing of time, the changing of the colors and the season. So.
And did you have to think about maintenance? Because I think this is quite an important question, as we want to see more biodiversity in our cities, how it's maintained and how was that approached in terms of the long-term care of the Strand?
Always you have to think about
yeah.
maintenance, for sure. Thinking, one, the types of plants that you put in,
yeah.
how drought tolerant are they?
Yeah.
That's always the particularly now. We've gone through almost 6 weeks, I think, now without any rain.
Yeah.
They've been irrigated because they're still establishing. But grasses are amazing for that quality.
Yep.
So making sure that you weave grasses throughout, thinking in layers. If you can create a cover and close the canopy, again, that's a message that James taught me. If you can close the canopy, it stops weeds from getting in, but also helps to lock in the moisture.
Right.
So there's devices and methods that we think about when we're doing the design, but always you have to think about what is the ongoing maintenance? How's it being watered? How's it being weeded? How's it being looked after? Like the alliums are coming to the end. They'll need to be cared for now because they'll start to look a bit messy. So but also I think there's an element of seeing the way in which nature and cities behaves and looks like, that there's an element where we need to be more relaxed.
Yes.
That not everything is prim and proper and cut and put in place. That there's the messiness and the exuberance
we
that you
see
in nature.
We can't have colors in rows. Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah.
You want that mix of diversity, not just biodiversity, but if you see diversity of plants and textures and colors, you're most likely going to get a really diverse mix of vertebrates and insects and the elements using the planting. Other inhabitants to the space, that's it.
Yeah, and what's obviously great about landscape is it looks better as it gets older, as it beds in and it kind of starts to really feel its, get its feet, so to speak.
That's right, so the planting that we see there was just planted in November of last year, so it's going through its first season of bedding in and establishing.
Yeah.
Inherently, it will change. I always say it's a process that we're putting in place, not a product. So when you finish, you're not, here it is, you've set something in motion, you've put the conditions in place, you've set a tapestry of plants and a planting mix, but how it evolves and changes, it's in many ways out of your out of your hands. You know, there'll be some strong species that move and migrate, others that will recede into the shadows, but that's nature.
Yeah, this project really started pre-COVID and was delivered during COVID or during the pandemic. And we're now enjoying it. It really is the perfect time now that we're all back in full swing this year in London. Did the pandemic impact, for good or bad in any way, the process?
I always joke that I was really worried that the pandemic was going to make people forget how bad the space was by the time it opens. Because there was this moment where you hadn't been in the space, you hadn't seen buses and taxis and shouting taxi drivers and people honking their horns for a good 2 years. So you come back and it's open, there's people moving through, you might have forgotten that it was such a transformation. Where it changed it was accelerated.
Right.
Because Westminster had this sense that everywhere around the space needed to get back on their feet. They needed to start to draw people back in, whether that was the cultural institutions, the universities, the churches, the businesses, the embassies.
So we can't hang around.
Exactly. We needed to get people coming back in the space. So what that did was fast track how we design the space, or what you see on the site was really about, let's get the structure that we designed in.
Yep.
There wasn't a lot of iterations or changes to that. It was more, let's use this as a moment to test what we've designed, find ways of delivering it quicker. So that became a shift in the type of furniture, for instance, what surfacing might be, what the edges might look like. But they're material changes that designers might see and city makers might notice. But for the general public, they're moving through what is a brand new space, and they're probably not seen as much change or detail that we were getting hung up on.
Right.
So it was about bringing that forward as quick as you can, get it in the ground, allow it to open, allow people to use it, and observe and monitor and watch it now and see, did we get it right? Is the scale right? Are people sitting where we expected them to sit? Will I have this curatorial program that changes throughout the year, which is the next? I would say it's the element of the space that hasn't been tested yet.
Right.
The overlay of installations of performances. And the other dialectic we set up when we began was this idea of creating a space where art is made, not displayed.
Right.
Dance is rehearsed, not performed, and knowledge is shared, not stored away.
Yep.
So rather than it being a place where you have a platform and you bring in a sculpture or you bring in a performance or you bring in an installation, which it will have.
Yeah.
Could it also be a place where you bring the creativity that's happening in the buildings? In Somerset House, for instance, could you have an artist from Somerset House come out and make a piece of art or rehearse one of their performances? So that, I think, is the element that will come now as we come into summer. And I look forward to seeing how people use it and how it responds to that. Because it's a significant space and it has the potential to really be a moment of real celebration.
What have been your sort of pleasant surprise, anything that surprised you? You do these wonderful tours, so you get feedback. You've obviously been in the space many, many times. Is there anything that you've seen it used in a particular way, or comments from the public that have pleasantly surprised you?
Not really, I've got to say. Nothing yet. I think there's that rewarding point when you see people using it in the way. Perhaps how flexible some of the seating arrangements are, that people use it in all sorts of ways you might not fully have conceived, sitting on the table, feet on the tables.
Yep.
I think the bigger thing is observing the social interactions that we've tried to create.
Yep.
So I suppose the surprise is how important that is.
Yeah.
We always knew that creating spaces for people is important, how they connect, how they socialize. But if you go there looking to have a conversation with someone, you're really looking for a specific arrangement of space.
Yeah.
Some are linear, so you're sitting next to each other, and that's not great for having a conversation.
Right.
You want to be sitting in an intimate way facing each other. For me, it's fascinating going there and watching that decision-making process when people arrive and say, okay, where should we go?
Where
should we sit? How should we sit? So that's been, I think, an interesting process. There have been a few lessons learned. One was about how popular cycling is.
Yes.
Mostly getting into the space and finding a place to park. So we had to put a lot more parking in so that it could occupy the space. And then also that shift when a big change happens for how vehicles come in and out.
Right.
A lot of vehicles, they would come in and didn't realize how to get out, and they were trying to go out the wrong way. So we ended up having to put another bollard because they couldn't get out.
Oh, they were trying to turn
the way
around.
They were trying to exit. Yeah. So there have been certainly a few lessons learned, but in the grand scheme of something so significant and the millions of decisions everyone had to make along the way, those have been relatively minor.
How do you think this will move the conversation about public realm, you know, large-scale pedestrianization of cities going forward?
I follow as much social media as I can to see how people are responding to it. And it seems to me that there's this overarching response of, if it can happen in a space like this, why can't that happen anywhere?
Yeah.
Because this is probably as complex as you can get. The amount of traffic that was coursing through, the different institutions and stakeholders, the historic importance of the place, existing trees, right? There's a lot of technical complexity and also cultural complexity here. So hopefully it's a message to say that if you have the aspirations anywhere, if there's the political will, if there's the funding, if you can make that happen, then people will respond. That's the other, I suppose, another surprise. It shouldn't really be a surprise, but the minute any kind of furniture went down, someone would sit
there.
It's like a pollinating
insect.
We've
got pictures of literally everything else has got kind of building materials around it, but someone has sat down on a bench that's been installed.
It was instantaneous. They'd finish putting it in and someone would sit down. To me, it suggests we need to over-provide for that, over-provide places for people to stop and rest and sit and socialize.
Yeah.
And you can't undercook that because people like choice, particularly after COVID. I think there's still an element where we're relearning how to be with each other in a public space. So if there's more options and more variety, more likely it's going to work for a bigger demographic or a bigger collective body of people using the space.
Yep.
And that certainly has played out here. We have individual seats, you have long benches that people can sit in, you have spaces that you can sit looking at each other. So to me, that's the most fascinating thing to now try to
understand.
Post-rationalize.
Learn from, because I think there's huge learnings from that.
Yeah.
Is there, I mean, it's a short space of time since it's gone live, but are there any learnings or results, or is anything being measured in Westminster in terms of the space and differences pre and post the new Strand?
I can't speak to the specificity of it, but my understanding, or I've heard it said, that it's one of the most measured streets in Europe.
Right.
So I think King certainly I think King certainly is monitoring all sorts, probably from air pollution.
Yeah.
Westminster and the North Bank bit, I know, are also carefully monitoring that.
Yeah.
So there's the environmental changes that you could see. There's probably the noise, the audible changes are significant. For me, it's a really interesting study for individuals to do is to start at Waterloo Bridge, where it's loud and you still feel a bit on edge and still feel a bit stressed. And then to walk into the space and get to that point where you can feel yourself relaxing.
Yeah.
You can almost feel the sounds and the stresses of the city falling away. So that's, I think, almost a measure that people are probably making every time they come to
the space. I've had comments, my kids have been there and they're playing, you know, everyone's relaxing and having fun.
And I think that those are decisions that people are making inadvertently. There's a natural, I suppose, instinct that we have to find those spaces where we feel calm. And nature does that. This ability to connect with nature and find space in the city where you have those moments is important. So certainly sound, air quality is important.
Right.
And then probably the measuring of, you know, the cultural success of it.
Yes.
How the institutions are brought together.
Yeah.
The ongoing management and maintenance is certainly something that will continue to be looked after.
Yeah. a number of people who are kind of spending time there that I guess would have been in a building at some, you know, rather than outside.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if it's like a clicker for how many people are coming and going. Because I know there's some, there are some spaces where they say, okay, how many have we had today? I think it's more the successes when you go there and you see the people there. And you see. Hopefully it's also the conversations that are being had. Yeah. Oh, I work in Kings. Really? Yeah. I work in Somerset House. Yeah. I had no idea.
Yeah.
Because it's that cross-pollination that we really talked about early on. Is so much knowledge and so much creativity and so much wisdom probably in those institutions and hope in the church, right? Everyone trying to come together and influence people in some way. So it's, I think that's what makes the project so unique, is it's such a rare collection of different parts of the city concentrated in this one moment that you have the chance to really brush up against or draw out and amplify.
And I guess that the institutions are delighted with the outcome.
Well, I would hope so. Yeah. I mean, I think for everyone there, it's a new lease on life. I imagine if I'm a prospective King's student and I'm coming there to potentially, do I want to go here or do I want to go somewhere else?
Wow.
Yeah. Since you see people on the
lawn.
That's
the first thing you see. And then
for Somerset House, the same thing for them to, a lot of it's just the sound, right? The fact that you don't have that volume of traffic. St. Mary LeStrand now has an amazing music system they have going on Thursdays, so they have they'll bring in musicians, and that's because they can hear the music for the first time.
Yeah,
right. Even when it was horse-drawn carriage, you know, the windows, there are no windows on the ground floor for that reason, because you would have probably had cobbles and
clack. Yeah,
it's a real game changer for them, certainly as well.
Well, it's an amazing project, and it's amazing to show. I think the scale of it shows, and in London, as you said, one of the busiest streets, to show what can be done is fantastic. So we've talked about the meanwhile and the permanent parts of the Strand. What's the vision for how long is the meanwhile areas going to be in place? And what are you looking for? What are you looking to test? And when will those become permanent?
If you visit on either end of the space, there's what feels like a secure edge. It's the hostile vehicle mitigation. It's the secure edge of the space. So on the outside of each of those areas is permanent natural stone. So it's it's York stone, it's Indian sandstone. It feels that it's been designed, it's there for a durable city material. As you step through those thresholds, it is a surface-dressed tarmac. And it's an articulated surface. It looks like a public space.
Yeah.
It doesn't look like a road. And it's really important, that surfacing. There's a part that hasn't been surfaced yet, which I'm really excited to finally finish on the south side of the church.
Yeah.
And that will give that sense that it's not a road at all. It's really about public space. So between those two HVM sections, the central part of the space outside Somerset House and King's, that, my understanding, is a 3 to 5 year testing period.
Right.
So it's a chance for the stakeholders that are looking to manage and maintain the space to understand what operational structures are in place to make sure that that can happen in the long term. They can test how people are using it to make sure that we've got it right.
As far
as, are there enough places for people to sit? Is the space where we want to have events large enough?
Yep.
Does it work with the movements and operations and delivery and servicing? And it's rare. I gotta say, it's a rare opportunity where you have a chance to test an idea.
Yeah.
At quite a high level. Like, this isn't a meanwhile scheme you expect to see where you have some tires laid in there, maybe some planters that have been painted.
A few boxes.
Painted the night before, right? This is putting proper investment and infrastructure in to see how it performs. To then test it and say, okay, what's working, what's not?
Yeah.
We need to make adjustments. If not, then let's get some hard-wearing, durable, natural stone in.
And will you be involved in that? Or you don't know?
I hope so. Yeah, it'd be great to see that vision carried all the way through. But at this stage, I do feel that the structure of how we envision the space really is there.
Yeah.
And from what I've seen, I feel confident it's performing the way that we wanted it to. There's nothing where I go, oh, the scale's not quite right there.
Right.
Oh, we need more seating there. The planting I wish was taller or had more density or something there. So it feels that the way in which we've laid it out and the structure and the variety is working. It's a case then of having conversations about what should the materiality of the city be?
Yeah.
And I think this is where the conversations around the climate emergency might become interesting. Is it better to have a tarmac surface that has this dressing that can be fixed if you have to do utility repairs and put back down? Or is it better to get that long-term natural stone in that has the durability to last for hundreds of years?
Yeah.
And these are conversations I think that people that are listening most likely to this are having every day about how do we make our material choices? What are those metrics that help us to ultimately say this is the direction of travel? But I think really it's a chance to see how it performs culturally and socially and urbanistically and then make those material conversations, changes and implementation.
Thank you. What made you want to become a landscape architect?
So I was already enrolled in, so I'm American, so I was enrolled in college, university if you have it, and I was going to become a fisheries biologist, and then I encountered organic chemistry, and that changed everything. In truth, it was, my brain didn't work in organic chemistry terms. At the time, my family was having some work done to the inside of their house, and the landscape architect was helping to spatialize it. And I just had a call and said, you should look into this. It might be a really interesting combination of creativity and analytics and engineering and math and that sort of stuff. And it really is. It's a combination of both sides of the brain. You're thinking in a creative sense, but then you're thinking practically, how do we problem solve
it happen?
And put it together?
Yeah.
So it turns out the college that I was at had an incredible landscape architecture program. So I didn't have to even change schools or anything. And my first course was the history of landscape architecture, going back to Queen Hatshepsut's temple. And then the whole trajectory of where we are today. And I was drawn in, thought, wow, what an amazing, amazing thing about how it's evolved through the different parts of society and can almost be measured. The Medici's, then you have the French formality, the English landscape movement. Like these are measures for how society was changing as much as garden making or landscape making. So there's real agency. It shows that there's agency about creating culture.
And do you see that we're at a point at the moment where we've got a real focus on the importance of outdoor space and the spaces in between buildings? Do you feel that there's a turning point, or is it, to you, is this just what should have been happening for a long time?
I think there is a turning point that's also, I would say it's, I've heard others say this, this is our moment as landscape architects. And I really, so when I moved here in 2003, there was a revival or a renaissance happening in a public space. Partly, I think, as a result of the Olympics and the political ambition to create better spaces. But if you think about some of the major public spaces in London, they've all happened since 2000, really.
Right, right.
It's this really, this resurgence of quality space, not just let's do something and get it done. How do people use it? Why is it important? How do you design in a way that's going to have a timeless quality to it that it can carry on through the city, but also that it's going to be successful to the different emerging communities that might find themselves using it? So I think definitely it's shifting. Now there's a conversation around obviously the climate, equity, inclusivity, safety. There's all of these strands, and we're right in the
middle.
We are imbricated by all of these major initiatives that people are thinking about. So we're wrestling with them. We're working through them. And when you see a successful project on site, it's a chance to go and learn from it. And that's the great thing, is you can walk through someone's imagination. You can be in someone's brain thinking, wow, how did they make these decisions? Where did they come up with and resolve some of these tricky details? And I can't think of any real industry that you can do that. Even an architect, you can't go to most of the buildings because they're probably private or they locked off. Here you can wander through a city and see an entire profession laid out for you to study.
So portfolio is right there. You can get right into it.
Correct. The music producer, Rick Rubin, he calls it the art of paying attention.
Yeah.
And it's that. It's like absorb it all in, take it all in. So I think definitely we're at a pivotal moment. We're all still learning, obviously, about how we address it. How do we think about addressing it? How do we make decisions about what we put in the ground or the types of trees? Where do they come from? The types of plants, the types of materials. It's a huge, huge conversation that we all need to have.
It's massive, and the impact it does have on not necessarily the physical health, but just the general health of a town, a city, you know, one that feels good about itself versus one that doesn't. And the impact then has on all of the infrastructure of the city.
And seeing things like No Mow May or Leave It Alone June or whatever we're doing now, you know, I think it starts to speak to a future city where there is, we talked a little bit about the appearance and the aesthetics of a city, right? Maybe we allow some of those areas to, not all of it, because then it introduces, we're having a conversation in the office. You leave it no mow for May, and then all its biodiversity comes in and you come and mow it down. But could there be parts of the city where you just
leave,
you allow it completely. You allow it to do its natural process. You allow emergence and senescence and all sorts of those interactions that happen almost invisibly, but really are critical to the biodiversity in the city.
And woven into landscape architecture and the profession is also not being fully responsible for answering the climate emergency, but there's a massive role and a responsibility. What is a thing that landscape architects and the profession can do to help combat the climate emergency?
I would say the simple answer is to get closer to nature.
Yeah.
And so that's a big umbrella ambition, because that could be anything from in-depth reading, really understanding what's going on, but also how nature works or how it's evolved through practice, understanding plants, like really understanding how planting communities come together, observing what's working in the city. Because ultimately, we need to put stuff in the ground that's going to work.
Yeah.
If it doesn't and it fails because we're being experimental, then it's not doing anyone any favors. It's going to cost more. It's not going to really look good. So certainly, I think we need to see what's going on and study nature in that sense. Like it's a whole urban ecology, isn't it? It's like a different type of ecosystem that goes on. So insects and plants are even evolving.
Yeah.
I read recently that there's even some seed pods are evolving really rapidly to be heavier, so that when they fall, they fall straight down and can germinate rather than being blown away into the pavement and therefore never germinating.
Yeah.
So there is this urban evolution perhaps that's going on with nature at a pace that we don't yet fully know. And then, you know, leaning into what other people are doing. So I teach at the Bartlett as well. I teach one of the landscape studios there. And this term, we're going to try to lean into what E.O. Wilson was talking about with the half earth theory.
Yep.
Could you have a half site? Could half your site be living?
Yep.
If half your site is living, it's going to be more permeable. It's going to have more natural processes going on. You'll have emergence of plants that you don't have to put in the ground.
Yes.
You create the conditions for which wind blown and bird migratory seeds land and create their own sort of germination, and you have these gardens. So, you know, questions about some of these ideas that came before us, is there agency in those now?
Yeah.
Because I think we have to fight for every tree now.
Yeah.
I think we have to fight for every tree, fight for as much permeable surface as we can.
Possible. Yeah.
Fight for planting. Because we do. There's a number of meetings that I'll be in where we say, well, the aesthetics aren't right. It should be hard paved. It's easier. We have to fight for that. We say, well, maybe. But also there's this conversation saying, well, what if a city's more permeable? What if it's greener? What if it has more biodiversity? Is that a better future city than if it's this nice aesthetic, pleasing piece that's hard paved?
But also, who says that's a nice aesthetic? The more beautiful green spaces we have, the better people feel, and the aesthetic then should become the norm.
Yeah, and that connection with nature. So going back to what E.O. Wilson I mentioned before, so he's the father of the term biophilia. And this idea that you, as a human, you evolved into what the plants were already doing. So we evolved in this process of natural systems going on around us.
Yeah.
So therefore, we have an element of connecting with nature that we therefore feel better because we've made a visual connection to nature or a physical connection with nature, seeing insects, seeing other wildlife.
Yep.
So those sorts of opportunities in the city are important. And those are decisions that we make at the drawing table, right? What should this space feel like? How green should it be? Are decisions that we ultimately inform a site.
And lastly, if you could put a bench anywhere in the world, where would it be and why?
This, I think, is the hardest question that I've been wrestling with since you said, think about this. One, because the places that I would put a bench are usually in nature somewhere.
Right.
And you have this tricky...
should I put a bench
there? You have
this really
tricky conundrum of, well, surely just leave that beauty to
you. Yeah, yeah.
But I'm going to go out there and say that I would put a bench very sensitively placed within Pando, which is the largest aspen grove, largest specimen, living specimen on Earth. And I would situate it somewhere very carefully within that so you could just experience the cathedral of the quaking aspen trees, the cacophony of that going on, and really just, you know, observe.
Look up.
The significance, the fact that you're seeing some of these trees above ground, but it's all interconnected as one vast living organism that's talks about mycelium and fungi and all the communications that are going on below ground that we don't even see.
Amazing. That's gorgeous. A lovely vision to end with. Thank you very much. I was looking forward to this conversation, and it's been fantastic. Thank you very much for coming in.
My pleasure.